Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pop Health Podcast. My name is Gavin Ward, and I'm the host of Pop Health Podcast. And today we're with a very special guest, Brad Hively, who's the president of the medical group for Health Essentials. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us here in your office here in the West LA Culver City area. We also have our co-host with us today, Ryan Iwamoto. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you, Gavin. Great to be here.
Great to be here as well. Ryan, Culver City, is this a special place for you?
Yeah, I grew up here. I live just down the block in Palms, California, which is right next to Culver City. Went to Palms Middle School, went to Mar Vista Elementary School. So yeah, this is definitely home for me.
Very good. I know your commute today, Brad, was a little bit shorter than usual. Where are you frequently off to on your day-to-day basis?
Yeah, this is great. I live in Brentwood, so Culver City is a nice, easy drive for me. Our headquarters are actually down in Santa Ana in Orange County, which is a good hour and a half on the freeway. So thanks for bringing me here today.
Oh, you're welcome. So we're actually in one of the many offices of Health Essentials. Today we are in the hospice division called Hospice Touch, and Brad's going to share with us a little bit more about the different things that Health Essentials does, particularly on the medical group side. Brad, before we get into kind of the business side of things, can you tell us maybe something that folks may not know about you, maybe on your family life or some hobbies?
Sure. Well, being from Los Angeles, not many people like country music. I happen to be a huge country music fan, so I go to country music concerts all the time. I also had twins recently.
How old are the twins?
My twins are two. I've got a 5-year-old daughter, Maya, and then twins, boy, girl, Bennett and Parker.
Wow.
So I haven't slept in 2 years, so.
Nice. Well, I have a 5-year-old son and 2-year-old daughter, so I don't have three, but I do have two. Just had a little Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle-themed birthday party on Saturday, so that was
nice.
A lot of fun. So one of the interesting things that I learned from Brad before we recorded, he actually did his undergrad at UCLA, where he earned his BA in business economics and had a pretty good GPA there, graduated magna cum laude. And he also has his MBA from Stanford, the university's graduate school of business there. So you have UCLA, you have Stanford, and now Brad also teaches as an adjunct professor for USC's master's program in the health administration program. So UCLA, Stanford, USC, where are your loyalties, Brad?
Yeah, you'd think it would be difficult, but actually I'm totally a huge Bruins fan. It's undergrad, like that's my only loyalty when it comes to athletics, and so Bruins all the way.
Very good. We were actually talking before the recording a little bit about Bruins football, so we're rooting hard for UCLA this year. I know, Ryan, you're a Cal guy. How are they looking?
They're looking good. We are undefeated so far, and I know we're recording, but hopefully they'll stay that way when this drops on iTunes.
Until they play us.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, let's jump into more about what Health Essentials is doing in the world of population health. I know there's a big focus on end of life with your organization as well. Brad, can you tell us a little bit more about your role with the medical group and just more in general about what Health Essentials does?
Yeah, sure. So Health Essentials was founded 20 years ago, back in 96, so we've been around a while. And we have a particular focus on end of life care. So we look to manage populations of patients nearing the end of life. And we do that on an at-risk basis, so we're accountable for both the costs and the quality outcomes of the patients that we manage.
Okay, very good. And besides the patients themselves, who are some of the groups that partner with you guys? Is it insurance companies that are funding this? Is it Medicare? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, we're primarily a managed care-focused company. So our customers are people like health insurance companies like Health Net or Molina or Care First. And also the large physician groups in Los Angeles, like Healthcare Partners or FACE or Greater Newport Physicians, people like that.
Okay, very good. And then Health Essentials, the different companies that you all have. I know your focus is on the medical group side, but you can tell us a little bit more about Health Essentials and the different subdivisions of Health Essentials.
Yeah, sure. So Health Essentials has four service lines that we offer. And we think about the four service lines on the spectrum of end of life. So we take care of actively dying patients in our hospice, and that's for patients with a prognosis of less than 6 months left to live. So that's a separate division. We run in two divisions, hospice and medical groups. So the hospice is caring for patients in the last 6 months of life. And then our medical group cares for patients generally in the last 5 years of life. So our medical group has three services that we offer. We care for in-home palliative care patients who are generally in the last 2 years of life. Then we take care of patients that live in nursing homes, so long-term care, custodial nursing home patients who, statistically speaking, are in the last 3 years of life.
Gotcha.
And then we care for short-stay rehab patients who are patients that are recovering from a post-hospitalization in a nursing home.
Now, Health Essentials, did it start out working with end-of-life care, or did it sort of adapt as for healthcare adapted as well?
Yeah, it definitely, it didn't start out with that focus. We started out as a what's called a SNFIS group.
Okay.
A lot of people haven't heard of a SNFIS group, so it's a skilled nursing facility physician group. So doctors that practice in hospitals are called hospitalists. Doctors that practice in nursing homes are called SNFIS. And so we're actually one of the first SNFIS groups in the state of California. We're actually now the largest SNFIS group in the state of California.
Wow.
And so we cover 400 nursing homes throughout Southern California, Arizona, and Nevada through a network of about 200 nursing home doctors.
Okay.
Very good. And what parts of Arizona and Nevada are you all practicing in?
We're in Las Vegas and Tucson.
Okay. Very good. So can you tell us a little bit more about what you think your organization is doing to keep patients comfortable and maybe keeping them out of the inpatient acute care facilities?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we can think about that. We have really two different care models. So our care model for nursing home patients is different than our care model for patients that are in their homes.
Okay.
So if you think about it, for our nursing home patients, we really invest a lot in planning and education. So that's actually one of the key things that we find, frankly, in all of our populations, is that if you're trying to keep people healthy, prevent unnecessary hospitalizations, it really all starts with planning and education. We call it advanced care planning. And some people think of advanced care planning as simply advanced directives or pulsed forms. But it's really much more than that. It's a process of talking to patients and families, educating them about their disease, what's going to happen to them in the future, and talking to them about how they want to be cared for when the things we know are going to happen do end up happening down the road.
So with a focus on patients in a SNF or end of life, perhaps, how are those patients with compliance and following those directions?
I think without a lot of effort and management, that's a problem. Right, that's where we come in, because you know, you take your take a patient that has COPD. You know, COPD patients are going to become short of breath.
Yeah,
and there's nothing scarier than feeling like you can't breathe. And so, if you don't plan for that, and if you don't know what to do when that happens, well, then the first thing you do is call 911, and you end up going to the hospital and probably getting a lot of things done to you that you may not want done. And frankly, you didn't really need to be in the hospital in the first place. There's a lot of ways to treat shortness of breath that don't require a hospitalization.
So it all goes back to education, educating the patient, educating the family, educating any caretakers that are around.
The other thing is you also have to be there for the patients when they're in trouble.
Yeah.
So we think about one of our core tenets is that we have to have speedy response. We're there for our patients when they need us.
Yeah.
So we've got clinicians on call 24/7, 365. So anytime a patient needs to talk to us, whether they're in a nursing home or whether they're in their private residence, we've always got somebody to talk them through the problem they're having.
Excellent. You mentioned one of the problems is chronic problems that these patients are having, and you talked a little bit about palliative care earlier. One of the trends I see is a push to get palliative care reimbursed, and we're starting to see some momentum and movement there. Can you tell us a little bit about payments for palliative care? Is the funding there? Do organizations have to just absorb the cost of that service? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's been a real problem for the past 10, 15 years. Is that it's generally palliative care physician groups are money-losing divisions of larger physician groups or hospitals. And the reason for that is sort of by their nature, palliative care visits take a long time.
Yeah.
You're dealing with very sick patients who have a lot of questions, who have complex medical needs, generally have a family around the table that has a lot of questions too. And so the traditional Medicare reimbursement where you might make, you know, $50 or $75 or $100 for a visit just isn't enough to cover the time and cost that it takes to do palliative care well.
Yeah.
So I was just going to ask where you see the future of that funding, and do you see momentum from the payers or the Medicares of the world?
Yeah. So I think the industry is starting to take note mm-hmm. of the real dearth of palliative care providers and services around the country. And also the industry, especially the payers, are, you know, they understand how much costs are associated with patients at the end of life. And they're starting to recognize that, you know, the way to have better outcomes and lower costs for patients at the end of life is to invest more heavily in palliative care.
Well, nice to see that momentum, Ryan.
Yeah, no, I was just going to ask, for someone that's not in hospice or knows the hospice business, you know, we see a lot of organizations investing in the palliative care side. What would be the benefit of doing that or investing in palliative care when, you know, it is a money loser for an organization?
Yeah. Okay, so think about this. If you're a health insurance company and you look at the last year of life, if mm-hmm. you look back at when your patients die, and then you calculate what their costs were in the last year of life, it would be about $50,000 per person per year.
Yeah.
Extremely expensive. So roughly 4 to 5% of Medicare patients die every year. And those 4 to 5% of patients consume 25% of all healthcare expenditures.
Wow.
And the frustrating thing is that the outcomes are not good. I mean, of course, these patients are going to be more expensive than average. They have more needs. But the problem is we're spending a lot of money on these patients, and they receive a lot of unnecessary, unhelpful, or futile care.
Yeah.
Frequently, their care is poorly coordinated. So on average, they'll see 15 doctors in the last 3 months of their life. I think maybe the saddest thing is that frequently the care they receive does not really match the care they desire. I mean, if you, you know, one of the things that we try to do,
yeah,
we try to identify patients early, you know, prior to, you know, they have a week left to live. We're trying to identify patients a year or 2 years prior to death. And we talk to them about, okay, here's your disease. Here's your prognosis. Here's what you can expect to happen. Now tell us how you want to be cared for. What's most important to you? What are your values? Do you want to try to prolong life as long as possible?
Yeah.
And if you do, okay, we're going to advocate for you and make sure that you get every life prolonging, life sustaining treatment. Or maybe your values are that you want to be able to read, or you want to be able to go for walks, or you want to be able to talk to your family, or you want to be comfortable and without pain. And so if those are your goals, we're going to advocate for that. And we're going to make sure you get the care that you need to optimize your goals. And you know, the interesting thing is when you do that for patients, they generally select care plans and treatment plans that are much less expensive than they would get otherwise in the absence of this planning. And they select care plans and that ultimately when they do pass away, their families are much more at peace with how they were treated at the end of life.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. One of the things I've heard is physicians by nature don't want to give up.
Yeah.
On their
That's
patients.
Very true.
And I know one of your responsibilities is working directly with physicians, even recruiting physicians to participate in what you all are doing at Health Essentials, primarily on the medical group side. So as you're recruiting physicians or working with physicians, how are those conversations with giving up versus creating a care plan that's really going to make life comfortable for that person?
It's a great question. So that's something that's been shown is that physicians are actually very bad prognosticators on mortality. They tend to overestimate lifespan. And that's actually what we love about our doctors. They fight for us. They're patient advocates. We don't want our doctors giving up on us. And so actually what we do and what our approach is that we try to separate out the discussions about end of life from the standard paths of the care they're receiving from their existing physicians. Because it really is hard to try to blend those two things together. So we let patients continue down the care plans that they have with their existing PCPs, their existing specialists. And what we try to do is educate them on a parallel process about all of their choices. And then we ask them to go talk to their doctors, and we talk to their doctors, and together as a team, we come up with the right care plan. The thing that we have found that's frustrating, it makes it difficult for physicians, is that Medicare has sort of inadvertently defined how we all talk about the end of life. Mm. Medicare, through their hospice benefit and their hospice regulations, has defined for us that end of life means the last 6 months. And actually, they put so many regulations around hospice referrals and hospice acceptance that on average, the median length of stay in hospice is only 18 days.
Yeah.
So in practice, hospice and end-of-life care is the last 18 days of life, and that's way too late, and not nearly enough patients end up getting the benefits of hospice. So what we try to do is move way earlier, way sooner, a year to two prior to death, and start having the conversations then.
So I've noticed a shift as well. While the term hospice is still used, a lot of organizations have mentioned end-of-life care mm-hmm. instead of the word hospice. In your experience, whether it's currently at Health Essentials or in your previous years where you were working with the Heritage Provider Network, how do you feel that shift? Has that shift been successful? Do you feel more people are open to that phrase versus hospice?
Yeah, we talk a lot about what we should call it because there is a bit of a stigma, a bit of a taboo. Patients may not want to talk about end-of-life care.
Yeah.
Right? And they may not want to talk about palliative care. We actually defer oftentimes to our customers. If it's, Aetna or Cigna or Health Net that's hiring us to deliver one of these programs, we'll defer a little bit to them about what we're going to call the program, because we want it to be a program that patients are willing to engage with. Because once the patients are willing to engage with our program and they get in, we actually have almost 95% highly satisfied patients. So the patients love our service because we're giving them education and we're advocating for them. But not as many patients make use of our service as they could, because sometimes they hear the words palliative or end of life and they say, no, that's not for me.
Yeah. Sometimes a little bit too late. Like you said, 18 days, whereas 6 months is the prognosis. So
A lot of people think hospice is a place to go to die.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, because it's not. Hospice is a wonderful program. Actually, a lot of studies have shown people live longer on hospice than not on hospice. And patients and families are tremendously satisfied with it.
Yeah.
But way too few people are able to avail themselves of it.
Yeah.
So as you work with a medical group, and we've done a lot of discussions about end-of-life care, there's probably a lot of other organizations that are your partners or groups that you partner with. I know a lot of folks have to deal with DME. I believe Health Essentials has its own DME division. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. And then there may be other organizations that y'all partner with, perhaps Meals on Wheels type organizations, community-based organizations, caregiving agencies. When you all look at a network of partners you can rely on in the community, can you share with us what you like to look for in some of your partners or some of your community organizations that are assisting with your patients as well?
Yeah, sure. So we do. We have to have a lot of partners, because the patients we care for have a lot of needs. And so the way we start is that every one of our care teams is made up of at least one social worker to educate our patients about all the resources that are available to them. And so you got a lot of resources available through the health plans, through your insurance company. Like DME, like home health, home infusion. And then you got a lot of private pay resources that aren't available through a health plan, but are available in the community, mm-hmm. like caregivers, personal care assistants, if you need help, with a will, all that kind of stuff. So we start with our social workers to educate our patients about what's available to them. To us, what we look for is a commitment to a clinically driven organization. So organizations that focus on patients and clinicians first. We look for a commitment to consistency and speedy response. So organizations that do what they say they're going to do and are available to patients when they need them. Because obviously patients get sick and scared nights and weekends and early mornings, and we need to have partners that are open and ready to help our patients when they need them.
Very good. So a lot of the work that you're doing is probably mostly in the home. You do work with skilled nursing facilities. I do understand you can receive hospice services in an inpatient setting as well. Would you say most people tend to desire to be in their own home?
Yeah, 85% of people would, when surveyed, will say they want to die in their homes. I don't actually know where the other 15% want to die. Yeah. Hawaii, maybe.
Yeah, on the beach.
On the beach. But yeah, so the vast majority of patients want to die at home.
How have you seen your clients or payers when it comes to shifting money to services in the home? You've been in the industry for quite a bit, right out of college, based on what I know, or shortly thereafter. Again, you started more on the investment side right out of school, and then shifted into more the provider side. Have you seen in your career more monies go towards services in the home? Do you feel good about that? Do you feel good that there's momentum there? Do you see any challenges with that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. All of the payers that we're working with have plans and future goals to move more and more care into the home. So I think, you know, there's a spectrum. It starts out with telephonic care management and case management for patients in the home. And then you move one step further to actually delivering clinicians and services into the home. Then you support that with remote patient monitoring and telehealth solutions. And then, you know, sort of coming next will be, you know, actually doing procedures in people's homes so they don't have to go to the hospital and be exposed to everything that's in the hospital.
Do you feel, when you mentioned procedures in the home, so are those nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, is the are the reimbursement levels going to be, are they enough now to get enough doctors and nurses to do that type of work?
Yeah, I think there's still a challenge there. The the move across the country, more and more patients are moving into managed care.
Yeah.
And as more and more patients move into managed care, the reimbursement, the Medicare fee-for-service reimbursement is not quite as important. Because the managed care entities don't look at, well, how much do I get paid if I do a procedure in somebody's home? They look at what are the quality outcomes and what are the cost savings.
Yeah.
So if it costs $1,000 to do a procedure in a patient's home, but it prevents them from spending a night in the hospital, which costs $3,000 or $4,000, then that's a positive cost ROI to the payer. And the patients are thrilled, of course, because they don't have to go to the hospital.
Yeah, well, I know we're excited about that as well. What about social services? I know in other countries, for example, Meals on Wheels, mental health type services, things that aren't necessarily considered medical. Does Health Essentials either do any of that type of work, or do you have partners that do that type of work? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that that is our core focus. Okay. Like I said, you know, we have social workers that educate our patients about the resources that are available to them. But one of the needs that we see is that the networks of social supports available to patients in the communities are very hard to figure out.
Yeah.
It's hard to figure out, you know, who are all the adult daycare providers? Who are the Meals on Wheels providers? How do I get access to those benefits? How do I sign up? And so that it's something that's, we need to figure out how to make that simpler. That won't be one of Health Essentials' innovations, but yeah. I hope somebody figures it out.
Well, it's also, you know, navigating through that and also finding who's good.
Right.
Yeah, who has a good reputation. It's not like something you can go on Yelp for and really do that research. So I know healthcare has changed a whole lot, you know, within the last few years. What's on the horizon for Health Essentials? What, any new initiatives that you can talk about or discuss with our audience?
Yeah. So some of the big things that are, like I mentioned, happening in the industry is that patients are migrating out of fee-for-service into managed care.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that's happening in California is that dual eligible patients, patients that are eligible for both Medi-Cal and Medicare, are increasingly being enrolled in HMOs. And that is particularly prevalent in nursing homes, because the vast majority of patients that live in nursing homes are dual eligible. And so what we're doing now, really for the first time, is trying to partner with nursing homes and partner with nursing home docs to improve outcomes for patients that live in nursing homes. So that's been a big focus for us and will continue to be.
Very good. So one thing we like to do every week is have a word of the day. And the word of the day is network. Word of the day is network. For listeners, just a reminder, if you email Gavin at pophealthpodcast.com with the word network, you'll be entered into a raffle to win a free Pop Health Podcast t-shirt. And Brad, you get one as well.
All right.
So look forward to getting your shirt size, and we'll have one either brought here or to your Orange County office for you. We have about a minute left, Brad. For the audience, what would you say is the biggest takeaway from what we shared with today and what Health Essentials can do for the community.
Yeah. You know, to me, what I'm hopeful of is that as a society, we start dropping the taboo around end-of-life care. Yeah. Because it's so important for our elderly folks who are nearing the end of life to have the supports they need from clinicians, from caregivers, from family, to help them plan how they want to live out their final few years. And in other countries, actually, they have a far less stigma about end of life. It's sort of the American ethos that we never give up and that we're fighters. That has held us back a little bit about planning for the end of life. And so I'd really like to see that turn, and we're trying to help make that shift.
Very good, Brad. Well, I appreciate you touching on what can be a very tough subject for folks.
Yes.
And we appreciate leaders like yourself being willing to take it head on and provide that service and positive outcomes for us. Ryan Iwamoto has been my co-host today. It's been enjoyable speaking on college football with you guys, off and a little bit on air as well. And again, the word of the day is network. Brad, again, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you both for having me.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone.